You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Hello and welcome to Stick Together, the only national union program focusing on union news, social justice and workers' struggles. Stick Together is brought to you from NAM Melbourne and broadcast across the Community Radio Network. Stick Together is produced with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, keeping independent community voices on the air. We thank them for their ongoing support. Before we begin today's program, I'd like to acknowledge that this show has been broadcast from the lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respect to elders past and present and recognise that sovereignty was never ceded, always was, and always will be Aboriginal land. And we recognise the struggle for workers' rights and justice in this country is inseparable from the ongoing struggle for First Nations justice and sovereignty. On today's program, we'll be speaking with Jewish Australian activist James Crafty, who recently travelled to Palestine, has been active in Palestine solidarity work here in Australia for many years. We're going to talk to him about what he witnessed for the reality of Palestinians on the ground in Palestine and talk about the role that international solidarity movements can play. But first, let's look at what's happening across the labour movement around Australia with some union news. Rail workers in Queensland, employed by Pacific National, have escalated their dispute with the company. Members of the Australian Federation of Union of Locomotive Employees and the Rail, Tram and Bus Union have launched a 24-hour stoppage this week in response to the company locking workers out of overtime bans. Tasmanian public sector workers escalate their pressure on the government. Teachers in the Australian Education Union have introduced work bans, including refusing to administer NAPLAN tests in a move designed to hit the government where it hurts. Union leaders say the heavy workload imposed by standardised testing simply isn't worth the stress it puts on both teachers and students. Members of the Community and Public Sector Union have warned that if a decent offer isn't made soon, workers across the state will escalate to what the union says could be unprecedented strike action. Health and community sector workers, represented by HACSU, are also stepping up their action, including hospital cleaner stoppages and rolling strike. Firefighters in the Northern Territory have begun industrial action. Members of the UWU working in the NT Fire and Rescue Service say the government attempted to bypass negotiations by putting a substandard agreement directly to a vote. The union says firefighters are united in their demand for a fair agreement and industrial action and will continue while the ballot remains open. In Victoria, the ASU has applied for a protected action ballot covering workers across 8 metropolitan councils, including City of Melbourne, City of Yarra and City of Darebin. If workers vote in favour of industrial action, it could lead to the largest coordinated local government strike action in Australian history. And in Western Australia, workers at BP refinery in Western Australia have won a pay rise after taking industrial action. Members of the Electrical Trades Union, the ETU, along with other unions secured a 7.1% wage increase with back pay following their dispute with contractor Ventia. And that's it for the union news this week. Over the past year, the question of Palestine has once again become a central political issue across the world. Across Australia, we've seen tens of thousands of people joined in weekly protests calling for an end to the war in Gaza and demanding justice and self-determination for the Palestinian people. The movement has been notable for its diversity, bringing together Palestinian community members, trade unionists, students, Jewish activists, and many others speaking out against the actions of the Israeli government. And this has only intensified in recent weeks, with the war continuing across to Iran, Lebanon, and neighboring countries. Around the world, we've seen one of the largest international solidarity movements in decades, with demonstrations across Europe, the US, Latin America, and Asia Pacific. And while we continue to hear these voices stand up for justice for Palestinians, it's not often we get to hear from someone who's just recently returned from Palestine. One of the people that has just recently been there is Australian Jewish activist James Crafty, who recently travelled through Palestine for around a month, connecting with Palestinian activists and organisers on the ground. And in this interview, he's going to talk to us about the importance of international solidarity and why we need to continue to speak up for Palestinian justice. James, thanks so much for coming on the show. James, just saying the last time he was there was 2006, so it's 20 years since last ventured over there. I'm really keen to hear a little bit about what your trip was like and to paint a little bit of a picture for people who maybe don't know so much about Palestine the country and the people and some of the cultural kind of things that you're able to experience there. Just thanks so much for joining us to tell that story.
Sure, thanks, James. So yeah, so I got to go over there, and I think things over there were very different to my last trip. Last time I was there, the Intifada was kind of just coming to an end, but there were weekly demonstrations of Palestinians against the wall. There was a real sense of fight, even when things were horrific. You saw back then Palestinian children having tear gas and rubber bullets fired at them, and there was constant just repression. This time there was repression, but just there was a real, I think, lack of fight back, because I think people are just feeling so intimidated over there at the moment. The sort of the fascism of the Israeli government's really on the rise. And I think it's really interesting, having sort of come from last time I was there, the pro-Palestine movement in Australia was really small, and people in Palestine were doing all these amazing actions, and they're going, the world's not paying attention to us. And now going from there, where the Palestinians feel too scared to do anything, and then coming, and I arrived back just as there were the big anti-Herzog rallies, and here everyone is paying attention to Palestine or wanting to demonstrate solidarity. So it feels really different this time around to 20 years ago.
Maybe to start with, can you tell us a little bit about what's the journey to get there? What does that look like? Obviously, we know that, inside Palestine, Palestinian people are stopped daily to get basic supplies. And obviously, that has really intensified, if not being able to do that at all since the war began. But what does it like? How does it look for you to be able to get yourself from Melbourne across to Palestine?
Yeah. Well, so when I went there, it was a bit of a gamble as to whether I would be let in, because we do know a lot of activists do get sort of denied access at the border. And this, I have been arrested at pro-Palestine actions in Melbourne, and had been involved in actions there last time where I was arrested. So I was surprised in some ways I didn't flag on their system and I didn't get turned back. Certainly when I arrived at the airport, there were people who had Arab names and who were clearly Arabic, who were being heavily interrogated while I was being sort of flagged through. And I think because of my Jewish background, or at least because of my sort of more white appearance, I was sort of flagged through in a much quicker manner than those people. And so it's a bit of luck whether I could get in or not, but I was luckily got in into Israel or 48 Palestine. And then from there, going into the West Bank, it's a simple matter of, I guess, flashing Australian passports at various checkpoints and things, or getting on buses. It's impossible to get into Gaza. And it's certainly for Palestinians, it's harder to be able to go in and out of Israel than it was. Israel post the 2023 terror attack, Palestinians have been denied access to work visas in Israel, a lot of them, and that's played a significant role into diminishing their interaction between Israelis and Palestinians.
Before we started today, I was saying that I remember there was stickers around the Afghanistan war that and there was a bit of a campaign. I think it was really towards the end of the occupation and war then. It talked about Afghanistan is a country, not just a war. And I was thinking about that before we spoke today, because we hear so much about Palestine in, I guess, just as a battle against Israel and a plight for Palestinian people. There's also the beauty of the country and the food and culture and people there as well. Obviously, we want to highlight, the things that are happening and the activism and stuff there as well. But I wondered if you just touch a little bit about what the country is looking like and some of the kind of hospitality you got from people that you met there.
Sure. So I guess one of the things is Palestine in of itself is, I think, in some ways, multiple countries or multiple different groups of people. And I think part of that is the history, is that it's a place that was, under the Ottoman Empire, then under the British Empire, and now under Israeli occupation. And so it's never really formed as a sort of nation state in the same way that, say, Australia has formed as a nation state, or the way that a lot of other places have. And that the way that the Palestinians have been sort of divided by checkpoints and settlements and so on has meant that a lot of life is still very much village-based, or very much based in different areas with different cultures. And so I think that that has kind of continued and has sort of been exacerbated by the occupation. I think that that has made it harder in some ways for there to be different senses of solidarity between different communities inside Palestine. And so you go through, and so a lot of the places we were dealing with were in Area C, which is the areas of the West Bank, the sort of 60%+ of the West Bank, which is under Israeli administration, where it's a lot of Bedouin villages and Bedouin communities who are just so impoverished, who are surrounded by settlements that are sort of built up around them. And they're doing amazing things. Despite being incredibly poor. And then you've got that very much contrasted with some of the big cities like Nablus, Ramallah, etc., which are being surrounded by these settlements, are being surrounded by Area C, but are sort of less touched by Israeli army going in and out. And so they've been able to develop massive shopping malls and massive infrastructure. So the industrial, the number of buildings in Nablus has grown by about 80% over the last 20 years. And so you see these cities becoming a lot more crowded, a lot more cosmopolitan than they were, but it's difficult to get in and out of them. And they're, these are going to be the last places as more and more people are forced into them before Israel starts to touch those as well with greater impact.
So once you were inside and you assumed that you were meeting people once you got there, and what was that experience like? And can you explain a little bit to people about, I know you had some encounters with I'm not sure with soldiers, but like with different Israelis kind of pestering you and the comrades you're with. What does that kind of uneasiness sort of feel like when you're kind of moving around?
Oh, sure. So I think, look, things are getting scarier and scarier for Palestinians and for people in the West Bank. One of the big developments between when I was there last time and this time is the fact that now the settlers have basically been given their own army. So there's now army and there's settler army. So because the sort of main Israeli army is focused on war efforts and genocide in Gaza and so on, they've really been ramping up arming the settlers, giving the settlers uniforms and vehicles and so forth. So the settlers, as well as being the people who are harassing the Palestinians on day to day, are then also the day to day army that a lot of the Palestinians are experiencing as well. So it's like, police are monitoring their own quite literally. And the level of fascism has, really sort of combined with sort of social media. So you now have these sort of Israeli brown shirt types really dominating the settler movement, are going out there pepper spraying pro-Palestine activists. So there's a lot of fear that's being generated and this absolute fascism that's being allowed to perpetuate. And of course, from all accounts, things have got worse since I've been back. Because the settlers sort of use whenever Israel and the world's attention's focused on war issues and that to really make things as difficult as possible for Palestinians in the West Bank.
I guess, yeah, you're sort of highlighting what some of the kind of changes are over that period. And obviously there was, pretty big conflict, not like around that 2006 period as well. What does, yeah, is there, are there people that you were able to kind of maintain relationship with, or how were you able to build the connections with the people that you spent time with there and able to see some of the activism that was happening there?
Sure. So, look, I got in touch with groups that I had been involved with there last time, and there were some, old groups such as the International Solidarity Movement, and there's some new groups such as Torah Tzedek, which was an offshoot of Rabbis for Human Rights, and there were different groups that were doing, I guess, different activity inside the West Bank, as well as groups like Stand Together and other groups doing things inside Israel itself. And so, yeah, I just sort of, I guess, communicated and hooked up with them where possible. I think the because of the changes and because there's less people going back and forth in terms of work, it was a bit harder in terms of language than it was last time. I think there are fewer people that speak English and fewer Palestinians who are actively learning English and Hebrew and vice versa, Israelis learning Arabic. And so that does, I think, constrain things a bit. But still, it was, it's a country where I was able to get by and make connections and work with people.
How do those groups you're talking about, how are they able to kind of organize on the ground there? Like, what does that organizing look like?
Well, so for a lot of the Israeli activists, a lot of them are doing what we know as protective presence. So they go out, and particularly for those goat farmers in and the Bedouins in Area C, so those areas that are being surrounded by the settlements where they can't get permits to build houses, etc. It's really about escorting those people while they're goat farming, working with them, acting in solidarity with them. So there's a lot of people, a lot of Israelis who've started to come, particularly over the last 2.5 years, to support Palestinians in the West Bank. And so they'll drive out from their homes in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and work with those Palestinians to try and stop or to try and get in the way of settler attacks, although there's sort of limits to what they can do because the army is very much there protecting the settlers, and any sort of physical response to the settlers is met with collective punishments, Palestinians being jailed, and so forth. So we're there supposedly, I guess, to try and de-intensify things, to sort of provide a sort of protective solidarity. But as a protective presence, it's also sort of limited in terms of what we can do working with those people. And a lot of those people who are doing the protective work in Palestine from Israel, they're all sorts. There are people who are very militant, staunchly one state support a united Palestine. There are people who are, we support Israel, but we also don't want to see Palestinians get hurt type, and there's sort of everything in between. In the Jordan Valley, a lot of the activists I was working with are sort of 50s up, and so a lot are in retirement age, and they're just sleeping overnight in these Palestinian villages. And then in the Masayata area in the south, they're a lot younger. In places like Dumas and Mukmas, there are a lot of religious activists who are sort of Orthodox Jews who are wanting to get involved. So it's a wide variety of people who are getting involved in the West Bank from Israel. And then the Palestinian farmers, who really their form of activism is just staying put where they are and enduring. And as the Palestinians say, being samud, being steadfast in the face of the occupation and in face of increasing violence.
Yeah, I guess that resistance of just staying in there on their land is such a powerful point in itself, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about kind of traveling across to some of the cities you're talking about? Like what that was like, what kind of measures you had to take to move about, what kind of transport you're able to take to get to places?
Oh, yeah. So getting around the West Bank, there are buses and there are, I guess, what's called service taxis and stuff. And it's generally fine, I guess, for an international to go r get round. One of the big issues is that because of the way the West Bank's divided, is that it's difficult for people to get round. It's also Israelis are prohibited by Israel from entering the sort of larger Palestinian areas, and because of the sort of the breakdown of I guess relations between Israelis and Palestinians, is even the areas where Israelis are allowed to go, a lot of the Israelis have sort of been given the fear of God into them, that if they go into Palestinian areas, something bad is going to happen. Because Israel has sort of generated this sort of anti-Semitism and has generated, this, quite, and the sort of the fear of settlers, that then Jewish activists who are actually there in solidarity with Palestinians are worried that they might be misidentified as settlers, or, and so there's a lot of, I guess, gentle connections with Palestinians that need to sort of take place, and discussions are, and I think it is such a segregated country. It's a place where everyone is told to fear everyone else, that I think sometimes part of I think my role as an international going out with some of these Israeli activists was actually just getting them to let their guard down and have some genuine conversations with the Palestinians, and actually say to them, look, you have nothing to be scared of from these people. These are people who we're in solidarity with. These are people who are being treated harshly by settlers from Israel. They don't have a problem with Jews. And then sooner or later we're laughing and having beers in Taiba, where the Palestinian beer factory is, and so on, and making real connections between Jews and Palestinians in Palestine around the Palestinian struggles. So I think a lot of it, there's real fears there, and some of it's real and some of it's imagined, and a lot of the Israeli propaganda is overwhelming, even for Israelis who are wanting to do the right thing. And so I think it's a long road, and it's a lot of discussions and a lot of trying to build connections. For me, it wasn't too bad getting around, although the obvious thing is just time and distances and so forth. Although there were the occasional incidents where the Israelis would just shut down the city and sort of set up a roadblock, and next thing you know, there'd be like 200 cars stopped leaving Tiber as they're searching every single car individually on the way home.
And that's just nothing to provocate that. That's just when they decide that they're going to do something like that.
Well, so in that case, we actually think that we may have been the provocation. So what happened in Tiber was I and a couple of Orthodox Israeli activists with a group called Torah Tzedek went and filmed some settlers as they were harassing a Palestinian family. And they were sort of they what they do is they come near a Palestinian's home with a bunch of sheep, and they sort of eat all of the grass and things around that family's home, and they're there with rifles and so forth. And it was quite a scary thing for this family. So we went to observe and to try and stop that from happening. And one of the Israelis I was with was filming one of the settlers and was saying, you know, what's saying to the settler who quite clearly had a rifle on him, which was issued by the army, you know, which military division are you part of? What would your commander think about you doing this, harassing this Palestinian family? Which may have scared the settlers a bit, because then next thing, when there was this search of, you know, 200 Palestinian cars on the road as we were leaving, they were saying, well, what were you doing? And the soldiers were like, what are you doing in Tiber? And we said, well, we were here to drink beer, which was partly true, but we were also there to protect this family. And then when we had said that, the soldiers then pulled out on their phones photos that had been taken by the settlers of us. So clearly the settlers had been working with the Israeli army and had made the Israeli army in that division aware of our presence in the village of Tiber. So that sort of thing can happen where at a whim they just decide three activists is worth shutting down an entire Palestinian village, was entirely to intimidate us and to collectively punish those 200 cars worth of Palestinians.
Yeah, it's such a huge overreaction to some a small act of resistance, isn't it? I wonder, you tell us a little bit about I want to hear, I guess, yeah, about kind of the journey home and stuff as well, and what that looks like. But I wonder if, yeah, is there some other kind of stories or things that you wanted to share about what that was like, maybe sharing what if there was if people there had much of an idea about the global protests, the protests in Australia, and the kind of impact that maybe that solidarity was having with people as well.
Yeah, look, I mean, there were certainly, I think, discussions I was having around what was happening back in Australia. And, you know, certainly a lot of them had heard about the Adelaide Writers' Festival. And I think that that was actually something that had given a lot of Palestinians hope, was that example of, you know, intellectuals and writers and so forth in Australia saying, yeah, we don't want to be part of a festival that's banning Palestinian speakers. So I think things like that definitely were sources of hope for people. I mean, I think hope is really in short supply there at the moment. And, you know, you can see some of these small, you know, these farming communities. You know, there's one which, you know, Raj, which had like 500 people, and it went from 500 people to being eradicated off the map in the course of months after sort of holding on for 2 years. And so, yeah, so at the moment they're just really just holding on where they can. And it's hard because, you know, you're seeing daily, like, you know, fire bombings and capsicum spray, and the settlers are just getting more and more vicious. But there are people sort of organizing, and yeah, there's a lot of humor and you know, children around, and you know, people are planning, you know, their careers and so forth amongst all of that tragedy. And yeah, and it was really good to, I guess, be able to interact with all of that.
I imagine it must have been pretty difficult that as the trip was kind of coming to an end to be able to play a role in kind of small ways, to be able to be solidarity work and things like that, but then to kind of pack up and head home, sort of knowing not knowing exactly what's coming, but knowing that it's going to be a difficult road for the people that you're leaving behind there.
Oh, look, and it's been hard, and I think it's been really hard coming back here and seeing how things have intensified. Even when I was there was issues around, you try and do activism like we were doing in the village of Mukmas, where we were trying to stay overnight and support this Palestinian village from having further firebombings against it. And then the army would come in and they would declare it a closed military zone. And as an international activist, once something's declared a closed military zone, if you're caught in there, that you could be deported. So every time the army came in, some of the international activists, we would have to go and hide. So that, and even though you're there at the request of the villagers, since I've left and since the war with Iran has started, that's gotten become even more intense. And what you'll find is that the army will declare a closed military zone, and then once all the international activists are sort of forced out of the area, the settlers will come in and just bulldoze the sort of the houses and makeshift houses that we were sleeping in. And so seeing some of the huts that I slept in overnight, that I, exchanged campfire stories around and played soccer with the kids around, and just seeing that those places that I slept just demolished only a month later is heartbreaking. And seeing that we held on to that place as for as long as possible, and then once we were forced out, seeing it demolished, it is absolutely heartbreaking. And of course, some of those, the Palestinians will be stubborn and rebuild, and some of them they'll just fear for their safety and they'll flee, and then they're sort of holding on while they can. And but yeah, it's just every day more and more of these places are just being bulldozed and demolished, and activists are forced out by the sort of ridiculous military zone orders.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for sharing story, James. And I'm sure there's heaps more that we could talk about, and we could perhaps catch up another time to hear more of the stories. And yeah, it's difficult to hear what's happening, but I think there's some great moments that you shared with us about acts of resistance and beauty that exists there too. And so yeah, thanks so much for speaking about it today.
Thanks, James.
And that's it for Stick Together this week. Thanks so much for joining us on the show. I've been James. And if you'd like to get in touch with the producers of the show, you can send us an email at sticktogether3cr@gmail.com. And you can listen back to this episode, share it with your friends, or listen back to any other episodes. You can listen wherever you normally listen to your podcasts or at 3CR website. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you do, there's a union for you. And until next time, stick together. And to finish off the show, you're going to hear a song from David Rovick, and this song is called America Has Never Been So Great.
America has never been so great, but it could be. If the corporations in control gave back everything they stole, we would not be in this ditch. The whole country would be rich. We could have been the best, like the Norway of the West. But instead, from shore to shore, we're so homeless and so poor. Oh, America has never been so great. But it could be. We could have reconciliation in this very divided nation. We could have a truth commission instead of another damn petition. We could have a forward leap, but such things don't come cheap. But what if we seize the shares of each and every billionaire? Oh, America has never been so great. If we had had elections that weren't corporate selections between one fool and another. Yes, if I had my druthers, we'd have a party, maybe two, that would have the slightest clue. This would seem to be essential in a place with such potential. Oh, America has never been so great, but it could be if our treaties were obeyed, if kids weren't hungry and afraid, if class and race and gender meant more than legal tender. If it weren't all run by money, it'd be a land of milk and honey.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.